This is the Sean Hannity Show podcast.
All right, thanks, Scott Shannon. Welcome aboard. Glad you're with us. 117 days to go to what is a transformative election. The best election coverage is right here. And toll free, it's 800-941-SEAN if you want to be a part of the program. And don't forget Twitter, it's at Sean Hannity, the Let Not Your Heart Be Troubled Twitter Army. So in the last month, about 200 countries, delegations from 200 countries, convene at the United Nations, and the idea is to come up with a treaty that is going to regulate international trade in conventional weapons. Now, the effort, which is supported by the Obama administration, has a very vocal opposition. Those of us that believe in the right of Americans to keep and bear arms, and those that don't want the UN to have control over our lives. Now, proponents of this arms treaty are arguing that, well, quote, inadequate controls over international arms markets result in armed violence against civilians by human rights violators, criminal gangs, warlords, and terrorists, etc. And they really are taking aim. This is aim, no pun intended, at the United States of America and our Second Amendment. Now, ostensibly, I don't think this is going to pass because you'd need a two-thirds vote in the United States Senate to make that happen. But the fact that the president, the very same administration that gave guns to drug dealers and gangs and killers and murderers and hostage takers and won't even give us information about it through the Fast and Furious scandal, is involving themselves in something like this as a means to take away your constitutional right. Anyway, to explain it in more detail here, we have John Lott. He is the co-author of Debacle and the greatly expanded third edition of a terrific book. It's called More Guns, Less Crime. And Wayne LaPierre is with us, the executive vice president and the CEO of the National Rifle Association. Gentlemen, welcome back. Good to talk to you both.
Great to talk to you.
All right, Wayne, let me start with you. Obviously, the NRA is taking this very seriously here. I don't think it has a chance of passage, but am I wrong?
Yeah, I think it's very serious, Sean. I mean, what happened is after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the whole nuke freeze movement, all these hundreds of NGOs had to have something to do. They all morphed themselves into gun ban groups. So now what you have is the UN with this conference spending 6 weeks this summer trying to write an international treaty and a world program to basically restrict gun ownership to the governments around the world, making no judgment at all as to whether it's Iran or North Korea or Syria or whether it's some other government, and taking firearms away from civilians worldwide, including the United States. And that's what they're after.
What do you think, John?
Well, I don't think it's going to directly affect the United States because I don't think it's going to get through the Senate. But I think it will affect gun ownership across the world. I think the types of regulations that they're talking about here, whether it be gun registration and licensing, we know that they don't stop crime. And the claim here is that somehow these regulations are going to stop either terrorist groups or rebel groups around the world from getting guns. Individuals aren't supplying these groups with guns. Governments are supplying these groups with guns. You look at FARC in Colombia, it's Venezuela that's giving them the guns. And that's the same across the world. The types of
or the Obama administration through Fast and Furious. I mean,
right. No, exactly, and then all it's going to do is make gun ownership costly and more difficult in these other countries. You know, we have a Senate here in the United States which provides a bulwark against and protects people from these types of things. But in most other countries, you have parliamentary systems, and so even if, let's say, a government like Canada, with their relatively conservative government right now, won't ratify it, at some point in the future, you're going to get either the Liberal Party in there or the NDP, and they're going to ratify it at that point. And so it's just a question of time for a lot of
people. In other words, it's going to hang out there, and it's going to loom out there for a long time. And then eventually, you're saying, as governments change and more liberal governments come into power, that they would be more likely to adopt it.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, I see. My basic concern, Wayne, is that, you know, there's the constitutional aspect of all of this, where we would cede our sovereignty over to the United Nations, a body that has been historically anti-Semitic and anti-American.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, what the UN is trying to do as far as America is it cheapens our rights, it weakens our sovereignty, and ultimately it enables criminals, thugs, tyrants, and evil regimes all over the world because that's who will have the guns if the UN gets its way. The NRA message has been very clear. stop this attack on our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, our Second Amendment, and our American freedom.
Well, why would the administration even think about ceding constitutional, you know, ceding our sovereignty and control over the United Nations anyway?
Because there is a school of thought within the Obama administration that in order to be a citizen of the world, Americans need to take a lesser amount of freedom in order to fit in, that somehow American culture should bend to some worldwide standard. And I'll tell you, that's a critical path down the step of losing our unique American way of life.
Well, this is like the Law of the Seas Treaty, which is, you know, now working its way through Congress right. as well. I mean, we're literally, we'd give up fishing areas sovereign to the United States. We'd give up, you know, for example, some of our rights to oil and minerals, et cetera. And this notion that somehow the United States has an obligation not only to fund people in this country that need some type of financial assistance, but we want to do this worldwide.
Right.
Well, those on the left do.
Well, I mean, the Obama administration, basically you have China, Russia, France, the socialist government that just came in power there, the UK and the US are the five main writers of this treaty. And, you know, the Obama administration, whether it's been a ban on historic semi-automatic rifles, slashing the arms pilots program, putting in judges like Sotomayor and Kagan who oppose the notion that there's an individual right to self-defense, and the judges they've been putting on lower courts. I mean, I knew Obama at the University of Chicago Law School. We both overlapped there and taught there for 4 years, and I was able to talk to him on more than a few occasions. And myself personally, he told me one time that he didn't believe people should be able to own guns. And you know, you don't need to just...
He told you that personally.
Right. Well, the first time I met him, I went up, I introduced myself, and he said, oh, you're the gun guy. And I said, well, yeah, I guess so. And he said, I don't believe people should be able to own guns. And I said, I'd heard that he had been helping out with the city of Chicago suit against the gun makers. And I said, well, maybe we can get together sometime for lunch and talk about it. And he just kind of wrinkled his face, turned around and walked away, and that was the end of our first conversation. And most of the time that I tried to talk with him, that's the way our conversations ended. It's just he viewed my position on guns as being evil. And because of that, he just didn't even want to talk with me.
See, this is the thing that kind of scares me about a second Obama term where he doesn't have to worry about reelection. Because he didn't run on this agenda. He ran on a lot of bumper stickers and a lot of slogans. And people like myself and a few others out there, we tried to point out, you know, his radicalism and his radical views and roots and the people that he associated with. And a lot of America got caught up in the hype and the slogans and the yes, we cans and the change, change, change and Obama. And but you're describing somebody that had radical views, views that are contrary to our own Constitution back in the day.
Right, exactly. Well, I mean, you can even look, the Washington Post last year ran a story where they had been talking to Sarah Brady, the former head of the Brady campaign, and she related to the Washington Post a conversation that she had had with Obama where he promised her that he was working under the radar to go and impose gun control
regulations. Yeah, that's
true. Oh. And, you know, I think a second term where he doesn't have to worry about reelection. I mean, we just saw today in Politico a story where the head of the regulatory oversight group there, Cass Sunstein, is somebody I also know from the University of Chicago Law School, that he's going slow on approving regulations. I think right now they're just stockpiling them until after the election, and as soon as that's over, you'll see a flood of regulations come forward.
Yeah. What about what would be the requirements in the treaty? As I understand, there's some, you know, stamping regulations, micro-stamping regulations that make it, you know, all but inevitable, gun registration, licensing, restrictions, et cetera. Do we know what the nook and cranny of this is all about?
Well, those seem like the most likely ones. They're the ones that have been discussed. I guess we won't know completely until next week what's going to be in there. But one thing we do know is that we've tried those different things in the United States. Those types of regulations have been tried around the world. And all they do is impose costs. They have nothing to do with stopping criminals, for example, from getting guns. I'll just give you an example with gun registration and licensing. A country like Canada has had that in effect for handguns since the 1930s. And yet even the government there can only argue that possibly three crimes have been solved as a result of gun registration and licensing. And there's a simple reason why they don't work. And that is, one, you know, in theory, if a crime gun is left at the scene and you can trace it back to the owner there, then you can go and identify the individual there. But the problem is, one, crime guns are virtually never left at the scene. Two, when they are left, they're not owned by the person who committed, you know, the person got it illegally or unregistered. They're not registered to the person that committed the crime. And you know, often when the gun is left there, it's because either the criminal's been seriously wounded or killed. And so you would identify who committed the crime in any case. In that situation.
You know, Wayne, I've been reading about the new proposal by the left, which is they'd have these individual ballistic fingerprints, if you will,
right,
on casings after a bullet's been fired.
Yeah, I mean, it's just another thing to divert resources, divert police resources. I mean, anything but attack the criminal and get him off the street. I mean, the idea that criminals who rape, rob, kill, murder are going to line up to buy numbered bullets is insane. And it just shows you what a lack of common sense these people have. And you know, the American public wants to be able to have their Second Amendment right to own a firearm, and they want criminals that misuse guns taken off the street. And that's what the NRA fights for every day. This UN treaty, though, Sean, I'll tell you this. We have tried and tried to get them to exempt rifles, shotguns, and handguns, and they have refused to do any of that. Right now, this UN treaty covers every rifle, shotgun, handgun. It also covers all ammunition, and the UN refuses to recognize the legitimacy of any firearm in any civilian hands at all.
Right.
I mean, that tells you how crazy and extreme all of this is. All institutionalized within the UN framework, with a permanent funding mechanism attached to it. And we need to take this seriously, because we have worked with the Senate to get 58 senators to sign a letter saying they'll oppose this and a majority of the House of Representatives. But if Obama wins re-election, you can look to him to try to implement a lot of this through executive order by the back door and say, take me to court. And he's already trying to stack the judicial system and the Supreme Court. So if they get reelected, this is going to be a big problem.
Yeah, I agree. What about this whole notion of, you know, I go back to your book now in its third edition with more information and recently updated information, John. And, you know, whenever you say more guns, less crime, liberals cringe. They can't even believe the title of your book. But in reality, when you look at the data and the facts, the fact that you have an armed population and the ability of people to protect themselves, and we've seen instance after instance, we've discussed it a lot on this program, where, in fact, that's true. Where people have the ability to protect themselves, lives are saved.
Right. Well, I mean, just as you can discourage criminals with higher arrest rates or higher conviction rates, the fact that would-be victims might be able to defend themselves also makes it more costly for criminals to go and commit crimes. I mean, police are probably the single most important factor for reducing crime, but I think the police understand themselves. They virtually always arrive on the crime scene after the crime's been committed. And the question is, what do you advise people to do when they're having to confront a criminal by themselves? And simply telling them to behave passively is not good advice. I mean, Americans just have to look at what's happened with places that have tried to ban guns in the United States, like Washington, D.C. and Chicago, and seen the huge increases in murder rates and violent crime rates that occurred after that. Or look at D.C. After 2008, when the gun control ban and, more importantly, the gun lock laws were also struck down. But it's just not here. You look around the world. I can't find a place around the world where a country has banned gun control, or banned gun ownership, and seen murder rates fall. In every place, you find it either goes up by a lot or at least a little bit. But even island nations, which you would think would be kind of the ideal test case, where they can't blame some neighbor next door for supplying guns, because in the United States, the excuse has often been, well, the reason why it didn't work in Chicago or Washington, D.C. is because we haven't banned guns all over the country. People can go to Maryland, Virginia, or other parts of Illinois to get guns. That doesn't explain why it would increase, why we'd have these huge increases in murder rates. But as I say, you can look around the world, even places which would fit those ideal conditions, you still see increases in murder rates and violent crimes.
And it's also among the criminals. There's some belief system that, fundamentally, if law-abiding citizens, you know, if they give up their rights to guns, that somehow that's going to prevent those that want to commit crimes or be involved in criminal enterprise to get them. But I thank you both. I got a roll. Wayne LaPierre, John Lott, thank you both for being with us, and we'll keep an eye on this very closely.
Great to talk to you.
Thanks, Sean.
All right, guys, appreciate it.
Hannity Headlines, a bite-sized version of the show that you can take with you everywhere you go. To sign up today for Hannity Headlines, go to Hannity.com.
All right, when we come back, we get right back to the phone calls. Your calls, toll-free, 800-941-SEAN, if you want to be a part of the program. And don't forget on Twitter, at Sean Hannity. Hannity.com for our re-election map. Click on your state, your district. Find out who's running so you know where they stand. Hannity tonight, Sununu versus Juan Williams and Rudy Giuliani and Kimberly, all coming up. Oh, and Joe Biden, by the way, if you can believe this, Biden actually told people in Ohio, quote, so-called job creators don't build the economy. Really, Mr. Vice President, then who builds the economy? That's the point. If you're leftist socialist, you think everything should be run through the government. A government takeover of business, government takeover of industry. By definition. Quick break. Right back. We'll continue.
We know you never want to miss the Sean Hannity Show. And now you never have to. Just sign up for Hannity Headlines, a bite-sized version of the show that you can take with you on your laptop, your mobile phone, everywhere you go, even to your liberal in-laws' place in Vermont.
So, yeah.
And after a few hours of that, you'll be glad you brought Sean along. To sign up today for Hannity Headlines, go to Hannity.com.
All right, thanks, Scott Shannon. As we roll along, 117 days to go, the best election coverage, the debate, the discussion never stops, even with AJ from Houston now on Twitter, at Sean Hannity, if you want to be a part of the fun. I'm looking forward. John Sununu is going to be debating Juan Williams on Hannity tonight. That's going to be fun. Rudy Giuliani, we got a great show, 9 Eastern on Fox. All right, let's get, as promised, to our busy telephones. We got a Lib standing by, Cubby in Chesapeake, Virginia, next on the Sean Hannity Show. What's up, Cubby? How are you?
Oh, I'm great, Sean. How are you doing?
You doing all right? I'm good. I'm good. What's going on?
Oh, I was calling yesterday. I was listening to your call, you know, radio show, and you were talking about Romney getting booed. And I was saying that he should, you know, get booed because it's not Obamacare. It's a health care.
No, it's Obamacare. This is Obama's health care plan, a signature legislation. I don't even hear that he or his administration opposes the word. I mean, look, we're splitting hairs here. This is his defining piece of legislation. And we've got new numbers out today, by the way. You should take note of this. Because, first of all, we've now discovered that the majority of Americans see this for what it is, the tax that the Supreme Court said it was. Now, do you remember when Obama was out there on the, you know, trying to sell this plan, did he say it was a tax or did he say it was a penalty?
He said it was a penalty.
He said it. Hang on. So it's a tax. The only way it was constitutional. So he misled the people of this country. Do you remember how much he said this was going to cost the American people? Do you remember that number? If you don't, I wouldn't be surprised.
No, I don't remember right offhand.
He said they made a big deal of keeping this under $1 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
It was $900 billion. And remember, we were going to pay 10 years in taxes for 6 years of services to get it started, and so they were fixing the books from the get go, and they were being inherently dishonest. And the second thing is, then the CBO comes out and they said, no, it's not going to be $900 billion. It's going to be $1.8 trillion. Well, now we have new numbers out today. And Obamacare is going to cost $2.6 trillion over the next 10 years instead of his initial promise of $900 billion.
Well, I still say it's health care, not Obamacare.
All right. So it's $900 billion. Then it's twice that, $1.8 trillion. Now it's $2.6 trillion. So it's three times already, not even being fully implemented, what he said it was going to cost.
Well, that's everybody says something that eventually going to change.
Well, there are three. But wait a minute. But there's three lies that the president told to get this passed. He said it's not going to be a tax on middle-income taxpayers. Wait a minute. Well, it is a tax, and 76% of the payment and the tax is going to be on households earning under $120,000 a year. So he lied there. Number two, he said that health care premiums will go down. They went up about $2,500, and they're going up even higher. And number three, he said if you like your plan, you can keep it. Well, we're now finding out that millions of Americans are losing their health insurance once this law becomes effective.
I still ain't heard of no. I watch news every night. Yeah. I still ain't seen where y'all keep saying American is losing health care. I never seen a report on that.
Yeah. Well, I just told you. All right, listen, I'm not making any.
Talk shows is saying that. Yeah. And I ain't read the newspaper. I ain't seen nowhere on the news.
I just gave you the facts. Do with them what you want. I'm trying to help you out here. But you're going to believe what you want to believe. Also, there's a new study out today that shows the real world impact of government run health care. Now, I was on Michael W. Smith and his cruise up in Canada. I actually went from Saturday night. I was on the ship, got to meet a lot of people, Holland America. It was a really great time, but I was only on there for one day. And we went up to St. Lawrence and we went all the way to Quebec City. And then I got off the ship at about 7 o'clock the next morning because I had to get back home and be with my kids. But while I was on there, I did a couple of shows with Michael. Because I think their ballroom only holds about 500 people, 600 people. So during one of them, a guy from Canada took issue with what it is that I was saying about Canadian health care and how people flock across the border to get care because they have long waits. And we brought up the example of an MRI. And I asked him, well, how long if you needed an MRI would you have to wait? And he said between maybe 9 months, 6-9 months. And I said, well, you're making my point. Now, there's a study out today from Canada. They released their own study. How many provinces in our neighbor to the north in Canada's single-payer system are fleeing the country and they're opting for medical treatment in the United States? The nonpartisan Fraser Institute reported that 46,159 Canadians sought medical treatment outside of Canada in 2011. Wait times have increased 104%, more than double compared with the most recent statistics that were out in 1993. Specialist physicians surveyed across 12 specialties, 10 provinces reported an average total wait time of 19 weeks between the time a general practitioner refers a patient and the time a specialist provides elective treatment, which is the longest they've ever recorded. Now, we're talking, in that case, 4 or 5 months. In 2011, Canadians enrolled in the government-dominated health service waited long periods of time for an estimated 941,321 procedures. As many as 2.8% of Canadians were waiting for treatment at any given time. And in some cases, these patients decided they were going to leave Canada because of the lack of available resources and appropriate procedure technology, according to the Institute. And that is national run healthcare. What happens, you're sold a bill of goods. You're sold false hope, false promises. The government will take care of you. The government, everybody needs to be insured. They play on all the emotional arguments. They play everyone they can. And everybody should be treated. Now, there are free market solutions, as we've discussed many times on the program. They never want to discuss those because they want control. They want the power. And they make it they make you think this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. And then the costs come in. And then you find out, now we're already at 3 times the promised cost that Obama told us it would be. It's not even been implemented. By the time this is all said and done, they're going to realize they cannot possibly sustain the promises they've made. So the very things happening in Canada, I'll use Great Britain as another example, where they have the National Health Services and a government rationing body. Remember the death panels discussion? Well, the government rationing body in Great Britain determines whether or not the government is going to pay for your hip replacement or your knee replacement. And guess what they factor in? They factor in your life expectancy. So if you're 82 years old, your life expectancy is 80, and you want a hip replacement or a knee replacement, the government rationing body said, well, you live too long, you can't have it. And if you don't have any money or the ability to go abroad or go elsewhere, you're on your own. Good luck. That will happen here. Anyway, let's get to our busy phones. Mike is a Canadian, and he's in Tennessee. What's up, Mike? How are you? Welcome to the program.
Hi, Sean. Nice to talk with you.
What do you think of that study?
Well, you know, my dad had an operation on his knee. He had to wait 6 months to get a knee operation.
Yeah. How long did he have to wait to get the MRI that told him he needed the knee operation?
Boy, you know, I was just there last week. I thought it was an extra 3 months.
All right, so you got 3 months waiting for the MRI, 6 months waiting for the operation. How long did he have to wait to go see the general practitioner that said, hey, you got a real big problem here?
Well, you know, I don't have the exacts there, Sean, for you.
Well, let me just tell you how it works here in this country. If you have insurance, let's say, and by the way, I'm all for solutions for the uninsured or those that we say are uninsurable, those that have pre-existing conditions. There are free market alternatives to this, and that would be patient accounts, that would be portability, that would be, you know, in other words, competition across state lines, et cetera, et cetera. But if I needed a knee replacement, I could find out on Monday, and by Wednesday I could be on the operating table, if I wanted to be, in this country, with my insurance, as it presently is, without paying an extra dime, except for my copay, which is like $20.
Yeah, there was the premier of Newfoundland. The big fiasco there was that he took off to America to get a procedure done that he couldn't get done in Canada.
Yeah, look, my father had a knee replacement. You ever watch that operation? I'm a psychopath. I like to watch operations on TV, like heart bypass or you know, when they actually take the heart out, put it in ice, and they do all this work, and they're running it on a machine. And, I mean, it's insane what they're able to do. And I watch knee replacements. I watched the hip replacement once, and it's like like a hammer and a chisel, and they're carving out where the ball is going to go. I mean, it's crazy. And the new joint is going in. I mean, I really admire them.
Yep. But, Sean, you know, I'm a Canadian-born American citizen. I've been here 21 years, and if Obama gets reelected in November, I know the Canadians that I know that are living here in the States, we're all going back to Canada.
Yeah, well, you know, that's kind of scary. You know, one of the ways, and there are problems that people really face in life. I think, for example, when you have insurance companies that are bidding to get pools of those that are insured, pre-existing conditions have got to be included. I think, for example, most young people don't need, you know, anything other than a checkup every year. Most people, maybe minor, you know, things, they got to get a basal cell removed or maybe they twist their ankle or break their leg or, you know, I'm not saying that's minor, you know what I mean, but nothing life-threatening. So most young people really just need catastrophic care. That is, God forbid if they get cancer. God forbid if they get a heart condition. God forbid if, you know, something really bad happens.
Right.
In those cases, if you get to manage your own account throughout your adult lifetime and you put money in every year, and then that includes and incentivizes people to get a checkup every year so they catch things earlier when it's less expensive and less life-threatening. There are ways that you can do this, but it's free market oriented. It's not government run. The government is bankrupt of Social Security and Medicare. I don't know why people put their faith and their hope and their belief and their trust in a president that said it's not a tax, it's a penalty, in a president that said it's going to be $900 billion, now it's $2.6 trillion and going up and not even implemented, and a president that keeps making these outrageously false statements. I don't know why people believe it.
You know, there's the comment, Romney's the most secretive person. He's the one who's the most secretive. It's just where is he spending all of his money right now? This is not, you know, something else, too. Yeah. You know, I used to be a Republican precinct leader in Colorado until I moved here to Tennessee. And, you know, I get all the news articles, and he's spending money overseas that people don't even know about.
Yeah, good point. Hey, listen, Mike, I appreciate it. Good call today. Thank you for being with us. As a matter of fact, staying on this topic, we have Dr. John is in Jacksonville, WOKV. What's up, Dr. John? How are you? And welcome to the program. I see Newt Gingrich is down your way today.
He sure is. He's at Republican headquarters today.
What's going on?
Sorry, I'm missing it. I'm down here seeing patients, though.
What kind of doctor are you? We have about 2 minutes, so we got to go fast.
Sure. I'm an optometrist and been in practice 15 years, seen changes already since the healthcare bill was initiated. Actually, within 2 months, we had some of my reimbursements got cut from insurance companies by as much as 40%. And when I asked them why that was, they said it was the additional cost that they were going to be incurring trying to comply with the health care law. Well, I'm actually trying to plan my exit strategy, because if this health care law doesn't get repealed, it's headed towards single payer. It's going to force
the good news is this: if you elect a conservative House, Senate, and Romney, if this country does that, this will not happen. This will be repealed, because remember, they don't need a filibuster-proof Senate, because now that it's taxed, they only need 51 votes. Romney will vote to repeal it. So that's the good news. Now, the danger for you is you're going to be on pins and needles for the next 117 days because this is your livelihood. This is your career.
That's exactly right. I was on pins and needles up waiting for that Supreme Court decision, and I just felt like I was a deflated balloon after that.
Yeah, what a disappointment with John Roberts. Hey, by the way, while I got you on the phone, could I ask you a medical question? Because
sure.
I have one eye that's nearsighted, one eye that's farsighted, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so I have two different pairs of glasses, because they gave me the one pair that kind of adjusts. What do you call that one?
Like a progressive lens?
A progressive. It makes me dizzy. I can't do it. So I use one for reading, and I use one for distance when I'm driving.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not allowed to wear them on TV. I can't see. It's like I'm,
see.
Yeah, kind of. Anything I can do besides? I don't want to wear contacts. I'm scared to death of those.
Well, you could consider LASIK surgery. They could do what's called monovision, which would allow you to see distance with one eye and near with another. And it sounds like you're almost that scenario now, so they could just improve it to the point where you feel comfortable with it, maybe.
You'd like that surgery? Is it all right?
I had it done myself 9 years ago, and I still see better than 20/20.
Wow, that's pretty cool. So would I see 20/20 again if I had it?
Very possibly. I mean, there's a lot of things we have to look at.
Would they have to do both eyes or one?
It depends on what your nearsightedness is. If you're nearsighted in one eye and you're the right amount of nearsightedness, they might just be able to work on the farsighted eye to give you the distance vision you're looking for.
All right. Well, I appreciate it, Dr. John. Thank you for your tip and your good counsel. Thank you.
Hey, I appreciate all you do. Keep it up.
All right, buddy. 800-941-SHAWN if you want to be a part of the program. Remember, Hannity tonight, we got a great show. Rudy Giuliani and then John Sununu versus Juan Williams. It's going to be a Hannity classic. I can just feel it. All right, quick break. Right back, and we will continue. 9 Eastern, set your DVR for Fox News.
Sean Hannity.
All right, that's going to wrap things up for today. Let not your heart be troubled. When we get back here tomorrow, 116 days to go. We got a great show on Hannity tonight. Don't miss this classic Hannity shootout. We got Juan Williams, John Sununu, Rudy Giuliani, Kimberly Guilfoyle, much more. 9 Eastern. Don't forget, set your DVR every night, 9 on Fox News. Thanks for being with us. 116 days to go. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Thanks for being with us.